Wrapping up another busy week, you and I, Friday, August the 25th, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We started out with my thoughts on the increasing political divide in the U.S. Businessman John Kleinhines, a subject of author Josh Haven's new book, The Siberia Job, joined us to chat about his experience dealing with Russia's business environment. And former Democratic state rep from Bridgeport, Chris Caruso, weighed in with his thoughts on another recent Yukon spending controversy. So I'm, going through stuff today, going through the usual 15 or 20 or 30 websites that I at least glance at. Do I read everything on every website? No. I go to certain aggregators like the Connecticut Report and Drudge to see what's hot and what's not, putting together basically a framework for the show like I do every day. And I come across this, and I find this interesting, and we kind of touched on this about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago, when this song by this upstart country artist, Oliver Anthony, came out talking about rich men north of Richmond, right? And this guy, I guess, was an amateur musician, and he worked a blue-collar job, and he still does. And, you know, he put out a song that most people on the right loved and a lot of people on the left hated. But one of the interesting things here, and we talked about it a couple of weeks ago, was when Connecticut's junior Democratic Senator Chris Murphy, remember he, I told you that, number one, he said it was a good song musically, he liked the style of the song, but he went ahead and told his followers on Twitter, or I guess X now, X formerly known as Twitter, to say, hey, give this a listen. Number one, it's a pretty good song, and number two, you may be progressives as far as Chris Murphy is concerned. He said, hey, we don't have to love what Oliver Anthony is talking about here and the way he's talking about it, but maybe it's good if we understand the other side. Because this hard partisanship, D versus R, blue versus red, left versus right, is not good for us. Now, of course, a lot of knuckleheads on the left and knuckleheadettes, male and female knuckleheads, immediately snipe back at Chris Murphy, but that was his exact point. That we are so, and this goes for both sides here, we are so blinded by thinking that our side is right all the time. Now, one side or the other might be right some of the time. It might be right a majority of the time. It's not right all the time. It's just not. It's just not. I know some of you may be, that might be tough for you to understand, but neither side is 100% right all the time on 100% of the issues. You may think you've got the, you may think you've got the spiritual, the political, the intellectual high ground on everything, but you don't. So I found this today in my prep material, and it kind of plays off of what Chris Murphy said. And Chris Murphy fascinates me. I think I've told you this. Sometimes he says stuff that I think is patently wrong, bordering on dumb, and I'll call him out on that. I think I've only met him once, but doesn't take me knowing somebody to sit back and maybe make a judgment, at least from his or her public pronouncements. But, sometimes he's right. And I know there are people on my side of the aisle who wince, break out in hives when I dare to say that a Democrat, perish the thought, a liberal may be actually right on something. But I saw this today, and it's interesting, and I'm not going to go through the article word by word, but this is interesting. It's in the it's a Hearst article by John Moritz in the Connecticut Insider section of the Hearst publications. Connecticut Democrat Chris Murphy is on a quest to build bridges across America's partisan divides. And John writes the story kind of continuing the saga of the nerve that Chris Murphy hit on his side of the aisle a couple of weeks ago when he told his ex/Twitter followers, hey, check this song out. A, for the musical quality, and B, listen to the message. And maybe when he said we, I'm not talking about my side of the aisle, but when he said we, he was talking about his side of the aisle, saying as progressives, we need to tailor or better understand our policies to maybe get disaffected middle-of-the-road people and conservatives over to our side. And I say that, too, as a conservative, saying, hey, maybe everybody who screams and yells bloody murder, no pun intended, about abortion, should understand why somebody on the left wants to get an abortion. Should understand why, as an election issue, abortion, at least since the flipping backwards of Roe v. Wade, has become poisonous for Republicans out there in some pretty right-leaning states. And just the way Chris Murphy is suggesting that his folks on his left-leaning side of the aisle understand the economy and things like gun rights and abortion, people on the right need to do that too. But he talks about building bridges across America's partisan divide. How do we do that now? Now, a lot of folks may listen to me and say, well, Pacelli, you participate in the great medium that's caused this split. You're a talk radio host. Well, I am. I get that. I figure that out. After 4+ years here at Connoisseur, thankfully they hired me for doing this. But I tend to do my show a little differently. And I really, truly, from the bottom of my heart, thank the people who call up and say, hey, I may not agree with you, meaning me, the majority of the time or even half the time, but I like listening to you. And when people, driving in today, I heard that on another talk station today at another show. Isn't that how America functions best? And please, I'm not saying that anything I do should have any great effect on how America functions. But, at the time when we have Donald Trump surrendering last night and all this other stuff, and the fact that you have families, and I hear this all the time, not just from people who call this program, but I hear it from friends and family members and my acquaintances and social media friends long ago and even new that I chat with. The fact that we have such this partisan divide in this country fascinates me. And I was thinking about the people that write into me on email at paul@wicc600.com and also call this show and say, hey, I disagree with you, but it's good conversation. Thanks. And I love that. Why can't we just do that? Because when you think about it, on some of these issues, now there is a great divergence on some of these issues, but we're not that far apart on other issues. Now, the Trump thing is different. That's a question of legality versus illegality, criminality versus non-criminality. That's another level, and we'll get to that later today. Plus, a funny story, too, is developing out of that. But I guess my question is, to start us off here, and I was kind of, this kind of was prodded out of my brain by reading this story. Chris Murphy is on a quest to build bridges across America's partisan divides. How do we get closer as a country and realize that we need to at least understand where people are coming from? And I try and force myself to do that. I don't take the frankly boorish and just numbing practice that some people in my business take, that everything on the right is right and everything on the left is wrong. No, in fact, a strength of what you should be on the right is understanding that different people have different ideas about things that you might be adult enough not to agree with, but you respect. And how do we get back to where we used to be when, we've always had divides in this country. But now it's just ridiculous. And is it the fault of cable news or what I do here or social media? See, I think part of the fault is that people love hearing people who echo what they think. And it, in some way, shape, or form, it validates what they're thinking. So if you were constantly deluged by people who you choose to listen to, who only agree with what you say, is that not just simply giving you comfort food? Is that a big bowl of macaroni and cheese or lobster mac and cheese or bacon mac and cheese? And you sit, see, he agrees with me, and this intellectual political mac and cheese is just so good. How do we get back to, or how do we get away from this belief that if you're a liberal, 98% of what the right believes is wrong, and if you're a conservative, 98% of what the left believes is wrong? Is anything really wrong? And it doesn't mean you can't criticize political operatives or things they do, but is it time for us, and again, you know, starting off this story about building bridges across America, and I'm not trying to sound like, you know, herb tea, kumbaya, and biscuits here. Listen, as you know, I love a good fight politically as well as the next guy or gal. But have we stopped realizing something that I always like to put out there? That what a person believes, especially in politics and social issues, it's based on their life. Have we stopped considering that it's not just our life that is important, it's the lived life or lives of people other than us? And I'm not saying, again, I'm not saying to you have to back down from anything and everything you believe. No, you don't have to do that. But what about just taking a breath and engaging people more than we're apparently doing now? And as Chris Murphy says, you know, it doesn't seem to be getting any better. What do you think about that? Or are you going to say, no, screw everybody. I agree with what I agree with. I believe with what I believe with, and I'm happy with that. And I don't want to see anybody's point of view on anything else. Fascinating subject up to us right now as we take a break from all the political stuff and delve back a few years to the early 90s, the post-Soviet Union Russia that was emerging from, again, the old Soviet Union. And a lot of folks went in there and did business. Our next guest is the CEO of Klein Hines, Capital Partners, the investment and advisory group for the global undervalued securities. Now, that was one of the earliest funds to invest in Russia, and it was formed at the inception of the Russian stock market back in 1994. Now, to further add some fascination to this, he is portrayed in a new novel. His name in the novel is John Mills. The name of the book, The Siberia Job by Josh Haven. And we have the real John Mills with us. John Klein Hines joins us right here on WICC. Hey there, John. It's Paul in Connecticut. How are you?
Excellent, Paul. Thank you.
You got into Russia to help, I guess, at the outset of the Russian stock market, 1994. What led you there, and how was that? How did somebody? What's the instruction manual for this, John, to go into post-Soviet Russia? And I mean, honestly, were there guys there that went, "Oh, Klein Hines, you want to work with us here?" I mean, what was that like? Tell your story.
Well, just to give you a little background, the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, and the whole Russian economy went into a tailspin for a couple of years as they transitioned from a command economy where they told factories how much to produce and where to deliver it, and they paid workers with worthless money. And it took a few years for the market economy to begin to flourish, and by 1992, 1993, these factories were all retooling, and they were starting to make things that people wanted, and they were exporting products. And the World Bank and the EBRD went in with a program to sort of jumpstart a Russian capital market, mm-hmm. stock market and money markets. And they'd done this previously. They'd done it in the Czech Republic and Hungary and Poland, and it had been quite successful using this voucher auction method. And so when we went into Russia, there were a lot of us, emerging market stock investors there. And mm-hmm. we just saw it as a once in a lifetime opportunity to buy huge companies, huge oil companies and telephone companies and utilities that were valued at, you know, 1 to 2% of their intrinsic net worth, what they would be trading for if they were listed in the U.S. or Europe. So it was kind of a once in a lifetime opportunity, and it was a lot of fun at the time.
A lot of fun at the time. What do you mean by fun? Describe fun for somebody in your line of work.
Well, we'd show up. First of all, there were just a lot of people there. People get very excited about the prospect of making money, and you could feel it in the air in Moscow in the mid 90s. I'd actually been there a couple years earlier in 92, and there were no cars on the street, and people were walking around the sidewalks slumped over, and there were no goods in the shops. And flash forward about 18 months, and the Moscow was a completely different place. Everybody had a deal they wanted to do. The traffic was unbelievable. There were new restaurants and new hotels opening up every week, and money was just flooding into Russia. Everybody wanted to get in on the ground floor as Russia transitioned to a free market economy. So it was fun. You'd work all day, and you'd it was all about information, where you could get information on these companies that were being sold. And then Moscow had a very exciting nightlife. So it was a fun episode in my career. And that's why I decided I wanted to write about it.
Yeah. How did you become John Mills in the Josh Haven book, The Siberia Job?
So, What happened is we did a really exciting transaction in Russia in 1994, where we bought stock in the largest company in Russia, a company called Gazprom. Mm-hmm. And we had a group of folks who worked on it all together, and there were maybe 35 or 40 of us, investors, people from the folks from the Czech Republic who had done this successfully in the Czech Republic prior to this. I'd always wanted to tell this story. It was such an interesting story, and it was so different from everything else I've done in my career. I just always thought I wanted to write a book. And then my partner in the transaction, a fellow by the name of Peter Kellner, was tragically killed in a helicopter ski accident in Alaska a couple of years ago. And it was early during COVID, and I just thought, you know, if I'm ever going to write this book, I need to do it now, because so many people associated with this transaction were gone or missing. And so I called the remaining people that were involved, and I said, I want to write this book. And I went out to a literary agent and found a really talented young author who could interview all of us and hear the stories and put it down in writing. The author's name is not, Josh Haven is a pen name, but the real author's name is Josh, and he did a fantastic job. So it's a true story, and it's a well-told story, and it's a very exciting read.
How does one do business in Russia when Russia was emerging from the old Soviet Union Cold War era? Post the collapse of the Berlin Wall, late 80s, early 90s. Name of the book, The Siberia Job. The author, Josh Haven, pen name for the author there. And the character John Mills is based on our guest, John Kleinhans. John, as we're watching this from afar with everything going on with Russia now, with the specter still of Vladimir Putin, how do you feel about what's going on right now? Not so much the geopolitical aspect of this, but should Russia be further along in its economy? Did you think we'd be here now when you were in there a couple of decades ago?
You know, Paul, that's an excellent question, and it's really tragic because things started off really well, and Putin became prime minister in 1998, and then when Yeltsin resigned in 1999, Putin ran for president and won. And the first 3 or 4 years Putin was in office, he was an Eagle Scout. He did everything right. He practiced market reform. He wanted to get close to the West. And then by 2004, 2005, the things started to change, and all of the security people, the KGB and the other security folks in Russia started to permeate the business community and really began to make it the market a very unfriendly marketplace for foreign investors and really pushed out foreign investors. So, you know, Putin, he's terrible for what he's done in the Ukraine, but what he's really terrible for is what he's done to the Russian people, because he had such a great opportunity to Europeanize Russia and to bring in great institutions, central banks and rule of law and an executive and a parliament and run it in a Western European, U.S. type free democracy, and he missed that. He went back into kind of the old world, old Soviet ways, and it set Russia back 20 years.
Yeah, John, and I've seen interviews with him, and what you just said kind of verifies what I've gotten from experts, too. For some reason, John, he suddenly made this turn, and you see Putin in interviews where he said, well, you know, the Russians lost so many million people in World War II, which they did, and we feel for their losses, and he talks about, I think, his own father that was killed. But in his mind, I guess, he was starting to think Russia didn't matter anymore. He wanted to go back to the old Russian bear thing. I mean, that abrupt turn. And maybe, John, was he influenced by people near him and said, you don't want to do this? This is not who we are? I mean, you must have thought long and hard about this.
Yeah, I think you put your finger on it, Paul. So you know, a lot of people think it was NATO expansion that upset Putin, or the, you know, oil prices went way up and all of a sudden Russia became a very wealthy country. But the reality is that when Putin went in power, all of the FSB agents and the KGB agents kind of followed him into the economy. And you know, there are 5,000 judges in Russia, but there are 250,000 KGB agents and FSB agents. And so if you have a business dispute, you don't settle it in court. You go find the strongest security people you can to do that. And what happened is all of those security people and that apparatus just sort of pushed Putin away from market forces and trying to be like the West. And they would point to things like the expansion of NATO and the fact that we, you know, Russia didn't need any more, you know, loans because their oil prices had gone up so much, and to kind of, I think, push Putin away from the what would have been the right direction.
And finally, John, John Kleinhans, by the way, is the guest. John, explain to my listeners here, for folks who kind of hear the term but they don't really grasp it, you constantly hear, the media does, the Russian oligarchs, the pro-Putin oligarchs and the anti-Putin oligarchs, some of whom tragically end up falling out of windows or having to get out of the... It's funny how that happens, John. But no, but seriously, who are these uber wealthy in Russia, John?
Well, that's one of the reasons why my name's not on the cover of this book, is because a lot of people do fall out of windows and break their necks falling off of their boats and things like that. You know, the oligarchs are a group of people who largely emerged out of the black market in the mid 90s. People who were involved in business, but in a kind of a shady way during Soviet times, and and they were able to get control of companies through a variety of mechanisms, and a number of them got very close to Putin. A lot of them didn't get close to Putin. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, Boris Berezovsky, you know, ended up dead. There's a lot of these guys early on didn't align with Putin, but many of them did, and they run these businesses the way the Russian government wants them to, and a lot of these people need Putin to be in power and stay in power for their own good. But it's largely a class of people out of the intelligence service and out of the various parts of Russian society who've been able to get control of large businesses and then use power and force to accumulate more business.
The name of the book, folks, pick it up wherever you get your books or online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. The Siberia Job, the listed author is Josh Haven. The character in the book, John Mills, is based on the experiences in Russia of our guest, John Kleinhines. John, fascinating stuff. Thank you so much and good luck. We'll talk down the road.
Paul, thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. All right, there you go, folks. Huh? How about that? Guy that was in early, when, remember, Russia had all these market reforms, Boris Yeltsin, they were all buddy-buddy with Mr. Reagan and the Bush presidencies, and now you have a guy that's just waging war. The Siberia Job, the pen name of the author, John Haven, Haven, H-A-V-E-N, the character in the book, John Mills, based on the life in Russia of John Kleinhines. Our guest. He's here for his weekly point of view, weekly wrap-up on what he's been looking at over the past 7 days. Former Bridgeport Democratic State Rep. Chris Caruso is with us. Chris, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Good, Paul. How about yourself?
Not too bad. What is on your mind today, Chris, of all the stuff going on? What has piqued your interest?
Well, you know, the issue that keeps coming back is UConn.
Yeah.
University of Connecticut seems to me to be, again, you know, issues one time after another.
you know,
very
Chris,
little oversight.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, hey, so what? They accidentally, Chris, paid their former president an extra $350,000. What's the big deal?
Yeah, yeah. And you know, Paul, I guess the question is she going to pay it back? If they paid her incorrectly, is she going to pay that back? And, you know, it wasn't too long ago that the governor was holding the line when it came to funding UConn, saying that they had enough funding to manage. And now we find out that apparently they do, because they had extra money to give away. And this just goes on and on and on. And I don't want to, you know, question the academic of UConn, which is very good. Also, the sports programs. But as an institution, at times it's out of control. There is no accountability. And, you know, it doesn't fall under any system. You know, the state universities are all under a system along with the community colleges. UConn is on its own. It has its own separate board of directors. It does what it wants when it wants to do it. It has its own ethics program within the system, its own construction review program. In some cases, it's exempt from other oversight that the state requires, and it just goes on and on. And when I was in the legislature, the big scandal was we were spending billions of dollars for, you know, building dormitories, and they built dormitories without fire sprinkler systems, and the cost overrun was unbelievable. And when I tried to, you know, rein it in, it was like I was stealing someone's baby, frankly. You know, because a lot of the legislators are from, you know, graduated from UConn or UConn law or what have you. And it's sacrosanct that you can't question, you can't hold them accountable. And it's really tragic because, you know, taxpayers' money is involved, you know, procedures, policies, state statutes and so forth. But it just doesn't seem to end. And so now, you know, we'll just excuse this as, you know, another mistake. We've spent $2 billion over the last probably 20 years in improvements to the university, which is needed. I understand those things need to be done, but the accountability isn't there. and their medical school system. We have problems with that, and it just goes on and on.
Yeah, and Chris, you're right. A couple things you mentioned there that hit me. Number one, you're right. UConn Health is now, again, there are great doctors there, great nurses. They do good care. But again, you constantly hear about how, A, UConn Health is a money pit. And Chris, I remember when you mentioned it, I have had legislators both on the record and off, Chris, tell me that, as you said, if you raise your voice a little too loud in Hartford or the Capitol saying, hey, we need more accountability here, you get the malocchio. I mean, you get the evil. It's like, be quiet. It's astounding, Chris. It's astounding.
It really is. I can't understand that, you know, our Southern Connecticut State University, Central Connecticut, the community colleges are all under this system with Board of Trustees. But UConn is a standalone. And when the issues came up when I was in the legislature and I raised them, I called that the Board of Trustees should resign because they had the oversight. And, you know, again, it was like I passed gas in church, excuse the crudeness. But, you know, and it was that bad. It's like, well, you know, what do you mean? And then I came to the point where I introduced legislation to make UConn the 170th town in the state.
Did you really?
And they all looked at me and I said, well, you know, they do their own thing. There's no accountability. The best we could do is let's tax them. And then at least they could run as a town. You know, they could get, you know, elect a first select person or a mayor and operate as a town. We'll get taxes off of them and they looked at me, and of course that wouldn't happen. But it was just trying to get the point across how ridiculous this is.
But
it
Chris,
really is.
Chris, I don't understand. And again, with older, I it was one of my schools I was thinking of going to. You're right; the sports program is great. They have great they have great academic programs. I know people that have gone there. Yeah. But Chris, where does the fear come from? I don't understand. I've never understood that. What are they afraid of?
Well, you mean the university itself?
Oh no! The legislators, the General Assembly saying, hey, this is tax money. What are you doing? What's the fear, Chris?
I think they have the university has such a good sports program that brings in money. It brings in a focus to the university. You've got, you know, graduates of the university. A lot of the judges in the state are UConn law graduates. You have people that do their undergraduate stuff there, their master degree program, and they just feel that this is a special, you know, land of opportunity, and that they're afraid of touching it. I think they're afraid of affecting, you know, the glamour of what the university offers, especially in their basketball program. Who's going to stand up and oppose, you know, the champions? You know, who's going to oppose that and the money that comes in with that system? And the problem is, all of that is great. It's super great for Connecticut, no question about it. But the university needs to have accountability and oversight. That's all we're asking for. No different than Southern Connecticut, no different than Housatonic Community College. Yeah. It needs oversight and it needs accountability because taxpayers' money is being used. Even with the oversight of state contracting, I believe they're exempt from that. Yeah. So when these abuses occur and overcosts that overruns of different dollar amounts, it's just, okay, well, it happened, so let's move forward. You know, I love the line, well, you know, you can't change the past, let's move to the next step. Well, the only thing that's getting hurt are the taxpayers and the accountability. And this is one example. They give $340,000 over to the former president of the university. So the real question is, are we getting that back?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that because I did read so much of that on the air here, Chris, to my listeners, and nowhere did I see an affirmative note from former President Herbst or anybody saying that money was going to go back. And, Chris, thank God for the auditors that we do have. They found out stuff about that. They found out stuff about the Attorney General's office. I mean, thank God we have some people, Chris, and they must be swamped with work. Yeah. But at least they're trying. At least they're trying.
Oh, yeah, but give it time. UConn will figure out a way of how to get the auditors out of holding them accountable. there'll be some in the middle of the night in the implementer bill for the budget. It will be that everyone in the state will be accountable to the auditors except UConn. Wait and see, Paul. It's amazing. It's like the land of. It's like a separate. That's why make it a separate town and let's be done with it. Because
that's funny.
That's what it's all about. How many kids do you have up there now? 20,000?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's a small town in Connecticut, right?
Chris, finally, before I let you go here, what are your thoughts on the political scene? It looks like a two-person primary, and then I guess technically we could have a three- or four-person general election here in Bridgeport.
Yeah, I think, you know, you will have an election with a lot of candidates, but whoever wins the Democratic nomination on September 12th will be the next mayor. Most of these parties out there that candidates have hooked to have no infrastructure, with the exception of probably the Working Families Party. The others really have no infrastructure to get out the vote. And, you know, it's a Democratic town, Paul. That's, you know, the registration of Democrats far exceed any other group. So I think the primary to watch is September 12th. Who comes out of that primary is probably going to be the next mayor of the city. But I, you know, things have changed a lot from when I ran for office. When I ran for mayor, you know, I lost the Democratic primary. I didn't run as an independent. I didn't run as another candidate on another party. It's changed. And I think now a lot of the candidates figure they have, you know, two bites of the apple. Mm-hmm. But in an election, it's going to be the Democrat that will pull it off. I just think that's what's going to happen.
All right, Chris, listen, I'm going to put you back on hold here before I cut you off. I'm going to put you back on hold because our producer tells me that Dan Hurley and Susan Herbst are on the phone. And they'd...
Keep me on. Don't put me on hold. Keep me on.
Wow.
Please.
Go Huskies.
Please.
There you go. Chris, take care. We'll talk next week. Thanks.
Take care, Paul.
Okay, bye-bye.